I appreciate your help yesterday when we were talking about the wonderful younger people downstairs and other younger people in the church. I tried to write down some of the things you had spoken with me about privately. I wasn't successful in remembering all of those, but as we go through our sessions together, if I don't remember the point that you brought up, please bring it up again. I do remember that yesterday Mike asked a question right near or at the end of the class time about would it be possible for us, while we're talking about the younger people and the things that we can do to help them learn how to conduct themselves, especially with relation to the opposite gender, would there be something that we could say for those of us who are parents regarding raising children of this age? And I'm sure that there is. There's a great deal to be said. Maybe next week we'll get into some of that. Right now, I think I might say just a word about it and then see if anybody else has something to contribute to. One of the important things, I think, is to know each child individually, because they're all different before we ever see them. Train up a child in the way he should go. And the precise way one child should go is not exactly the same way that some other child should go. They all should be Christians, if possible. But they're not precisely like pliable pieces of clay when we originally get them. They have different sets and bents to them. It's the parent's obligation to know the child, secondly, to love the child, and then also to convey that love. Many parents love their children but are not successful in conveying that love to the child so that the child knows that they're loved. So that's part of it too. Now, just how you do these things, you can help me fill in the blanks on, but I think those are things that need to be done. Know the child, love the child, convey that love, and don't say no when you can say yes with the child's best interest at heart. But if you must say no, then be firm about it and stick to it and try to do so in a loving way. Don't be overly concerned about what the child thinks about it. Now, can you help with an answer to Mike's question? Marvin? I guess we probably better get... Lowell's going to get you.
I think you can help a great deal by showing that you trust the child, too. A young man came to me and asked me what time the curfew was for the young lady he was taking out. And I told him that my mother always told me, when you're old enough to take somebody out, you're old enough to know when to come home. And she, with nine boys, she didn't worry, lay awake worrying about it. That was her philosophy, and I think it was a good one because it showed that she trusted until that trust was broken, and then, of course, you have to cope with that. But I think trusting has a great deal to do with the child's response to your suggestions.
I do, too. I think trust is good where it's appropriate. Now, as far as your example is concerned, I guess that would be different from one place to another. It would have been dangerous to tell me that when I was young. I wouldn't have seen a reason to bring her home before dawn, necessarily. Not that we would have been doing anything bad, but I just loved to talk in those days. And so you would have trusted me once, I think. But I do appreciate your general point about trusting young people where we can. And that's one thing I intend to say in the basement. Once you sacrifice that trust that your parents have in you, then you have to work long and hard before you can ever get it back. But if they don't feel there's any trust to sacrifice, then they might feel a little different about their relationship. Your point is very well taken. Ann, please, get the mic. Thanks.
Don't you think that teenagers do need some rules? And
oh,
that
absolutely.
They really do appreciate, even though they may be acting like they don't or resisting, I think if they know some rules, then they know how to deal with that and how to observe it. And if they haven't learned to observe it at that, say, middle teenage, why, later on they're going to have trouble. Because even going to work for someone and being responsible to be there on time and things like that, I think is learned in childhood.
Yes, I do too, and I do think they need rules. I think we ought to have a few rules and be sure we enforce them. An unenforced rule is sometimes worse than no rule at all. And we ought not to overdo it so that it gets confusing, but have a few rules that are well thought through. I think it's good if the teens can have some input into the details about the rules. But the parents need to be the parents. I even believe, and I have reason to believe this, that there are times that young people ask to do things which they themselves don't really necessarily even want to do. Or sometimes it's somebody else wants them to do it, and they're asking, hoping you'll say no. And it's a shame to disappoint them in those kind of cases.
I have actually heard some young people say they wished they had some rules. That's the reason I'm saying that. At the time that I had teenagers of my own, I didn't hear this. But since I have heard this from some young people, that they didn't have any rules at home, and they wished that they did have.
Better put a strong fence around the top of the fence than an ambulance down in the valley. That's what the poem said, and there really is validity to that. The key issue here, I think, is balance. We don't want to be too restrictive, and yet we don't want to be too loose about it either. And just knowing what that means in practical application is, I think, a difficult thing. I sure don't feel like an answer man on this subject. In fact, if you knew how inadequate I feel in dealing with this, you'd wonder how I can even stand here. So I appreciate your input. Was there anybody else on that particular point? Mike, I think we'll pick up more of this as we go along, probably. Did you have anything else to add to that? Go ahead, Mark.
Was this on trust or age?
Well,
what was it?
On the general issue of what can parents Mike's age with children his age do with regard to this? We're talking to the children about dating. What do the parents need to know? Go ahead.
Just on this issue of trust, if a child asks the question, well, don't you trust me? We need to be a little careful and think through our answer. Sometimes that gets confused with the question, don't you love me? And the answer to don't you love me is always yes. But sometimes the answer to don't you trust me should be no.
That's true. And even if I do trust the child, I may not trust everybody else that's involved in the situation. Good point. Lowell.
Many times I was at odds with my father, and we disagreed on a lot of things growing up. But probably my favorite thing about my father was that he always, I think he trusted me to do the right thing in the end, and I didn't want to let him down. I'm not saying I didn't let him down, but because he had such enormous trust, I think that impressed me to try to do as best I could.
I think so, too. I think if we have a relationship so that the child does not want to disappoint us, that really helps. I'm glad you said that. Thank you. Yes, Bev.
And Rick, I think that what we can do as a parent is to be and to show our kids that we're working on what we want them to be too. We're always working on ourselves, making ourselves better.
Right.
And when I ask them to do something, hopefully that was something they saw that I was doing too.
Right.
You know, you can't have a double set of standards because they're going to take the wrong one.
Right.
So you got to be what you want them to be.
There's no substitute for that. And part of that package is when we are wrong, we need to admit it. We're not fooling them anyway. They know we did something wrong. Fathers in particular have a problem with this many times, and I hear this intermittently from the children. And my dad's just never made a mistake. He thinks he's perfect, and he'll never admit it that he's ever made a mistake. Well, you don't. A lot of fathers, I think they're saving face by not admitting that they've made a mistake, when really the best thing they could do for themselves and their child is to just admit it. Because you're not losing anything by admitting that. You're still the father. I made a mistake there, son. I wronged you. I'm going to try very hard not to do that again. I'm still your father. I still have to take responsibility for your raising. And I'm not slackening the standards by saying this, but I'm going to try to do better than I did when I made that mistake. And I think a child will continue to respect you when you do that. Marvin again? I didn't know where he was coming.
I hesitate to talk again, but I believe that a mother and father have to be on the same team. If one's going north and the other's going south, it confuses the child. In discipline in particular, I think even if I have to bite my tongue or go in the other room or whatever, even if I think my wife is making a mistake in her disciplining, I should keep my mouth shut and we should thrash that out privately rather than before the child.
I sure agree with that, and I'm glad you said it. We need to work those things out between ourselves and then present a united front to the children. And you talked about it confusing the child. I think that's what it does at first, but the child very quickly learns to use that to their own advantage, and pretty soon they're not the one that's confused. We are. A wise child handles father and mother by playing one against the other, and they will drive a wedge there if they possibly can. Many couples get along relatively well until they have a child, and then the rearing of that child tends to come between them. It ought not so to be, but it's work to keep from having that happen. Who is it, Cliff?
Yeah. There's one thing I have observed in the past, and that is that if parents, we've already had comments on trusting the child, you know. If you leave the impression that you have very little trust on some particular thing, after a little while, the kid is going to say, well, they think we're going to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. We just as well do it. And that is something then that lays right square on the parent's shoulders. There has to be an alertness for a violation. This is true. But there can't be the total continuous expectation of a violation of something the parent doesn't want done.
That's right.
Or the child is going to say to himself, I have no hope anyway. Mm-hmm. And they're already convinced it's going to happen. Right. So let it happen.
That's true. Balance is such an important thing. As we're raising this child, we're turning over more and more responsibility for the child's life to the child. They learn to tie their shoes. We don't continue to tie their shoes for them. They learn to take responsibility in increasing increments in every phase of their lives. And as they develop and mature, we can turn over more to them. They're not all alike, and this is a tricky issue because we want to treat our children without partiality, and we should have some standards that apply to all. And yet they don't mature at the same rate. They're not alike. And so we don't treat them, well, what was the government says, in order to tax everybody equally, we have to tax them unequally. And they talk about a graduated income tax. It's a lot the same, I think, with children. In order to really be impartial, there are some differences that have to be made. So I sure agree with the point, and we don't want to err too far in either direction. Anyone else? Oh, Christy, go ahead.
Could you touch on the issue of headship? As the man is the head of the woman, even as Christ is the head of the church, do all women have a head? Young, unmarried women, their father is their head, right?
Yes.
When our country says legally they're adults at 18, at 21, whatever.
Sure.
Have to maintain the headship, but they say, well, we have to follow the laws of the land, too.
Well, there's nothing in the law of the land that says that she should not submit to the wishes of her father. So that's legality really has nothing to do with this issue in the Christian home, we hope. It's true that we can't force headship on somebody who will not accept it. Elders can't rule a congregation who will not have their rulership. A man can't force his wife to submit. And you certainly can't force a child of a certain age to do anything. But if there has been a constancy through the years, it's to be hoped that there would be some respect there. And there certainly is a headship. Now, it's not always a headship that implies an obedience as the age continues for both parent and child. when the father is 90 and senile and the child is 30 and maybe still she's still a single woman, she's 60 years old, there's a change, a gradual change that takes place through the years. She's always to honor her father and mother. Honor is not necessarily the same as obedience when we're dealing with people that are older. In the home, for the children in the home, they're very closely connected, honor and obedience. But there's still a headship there, as I view it, of a father over his daughter. Do you want to say more about that?
Well, sending them away to college, it's hard to maintain a headship because you can't always know what's going on.
No, you don't. And I guess after a certain point, it's no longer so much our responsibility. It has to be up to them. But hopefully we've been able to build some things in along the way. Wanda, go ahead.
I have three things to say in reference to a female.
Okay.
When I was 18 and went to Kansas City to work, my father well trusted me to be my own head, and he didn't feel that he had to worry about what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My middle daughter, her father died before she was 2 years old. So there isn't going to be no man that was going to be the head of her after that. And my third daughter, the father really wasn't around, so I still had to be the head of her.
Okay.
Thank
you. Yes, you're entirely welcome, and thank you. I didn't mean to imply by the idea of headship that he's ruling her every move, and I don't think you took it that way.
Well, I mean, he is more like an uncle to her than a father.
Yeah. When my daughter went to college, I had very little to say about what she was doing. I didn't want to have anything to say about it. But if I'd felt that she was doing something amiss or if there was a problem, I wouldn't have hesitated to speak up. But I expected her to be on her own recognizance.
This is in her total raising from the time of a babe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Anybody else? Dave.
I was just going to raise that question about what Christy brought up about going away to school.
Mm-hmm.
I went away to school. My oldest daughter went away to school. And I'm not sure it's everything that it's really cracked up to be. And we need to be very cautious about taking that step as a parent to make sure that we understand, is it really necessary? Is it part of the growth of the child, or is it part of maybe growth in the wrong directions that we don't want them to go? But being away from home forces you to make some decisions, and part of that's good, and part of it's not so good. So we need to be thinking about the maturity of the child as to whether they're ready to go away to college or not. Some are and some aren't.
That's right. And if we do think that they will be leaving at a certain point, we need to prepare ahead for them to be ready by that point, if possible. Lowell, were you going to say something? Or were you just, okay. Anyone else? Well, I appreciate very much this discussion, and a lot of it is very good. I hope we can continue this kind of a format. Let's go a little bit further with the things we've been talking about with the young people downstairs and continue to look at it from an adult point of view as well. I think yesterday we were in the area, or had just talked about the area perhaps, of Proverbs 31 and 30 about charm is deceitful and beauty is vain. This is a point I tried to make with the young people this morning because I think it's such a key issue for them, how they appear to themselves and to one another. So we talked, we turned to that passage down there, and we talked considerably about that. We talked about having a nice appearance within reason and yet not making that the focus of life, but rather concentrating on the inner person. And interestingly, somebody at that point raised the issue of braiding the hair and so forth, so we turned to 1 Timothy 2 and talked about the passage there, and also 1 Peter 3 and 3 and talked about those passages there. I just love your kids. They're just remarkably astute about some of these things, and they ask wonderful questions. So I'm just trying to make you aware of some of the things we talked about since you're not there. We talked about bodily exercise and the strength of the man and so forth, and how the beauty of the woman, the strength of the man, these things fade, so we've got to build our relationship on something other than that. We did talk a little bit about academic achievement this morning. We talked about setting goals in life, trying to learn to excel at something, how this connects with our sense of ourself and what we're like. How we need to push ourselves in some areas where we're afraid to do something that's worthwhile. And I used an example of myself when I was 9 years old over at a congregation in Kansas City. It came my turn to do a reading in a group of teenagers. Everybody else was 16 or 17 or 15, and I was 9. But I pushed myself to go ahead and make a public reading anyway, and it didn't do me anything but good. I'm glad that I did that. But if I'd frozen in fear over it, I don't know if I would have ever gotten out of that or not. So used an example or two along that line. Then we started talking. Yesterday we were talking mainly about why date, what it's supposed to accomplish. Today we started talking about who to date. And we talked about this in terms of dating Christian people. I think that goes pretty much unsaid, perhaps. I mean, it wasn't unsaid, but it's assumed as an underlying foundation that we're going to think in terms of dating Christians. But within the Christian community, is this person interesting to you? Would you like to get to know this person better? Will this person treat you right? Do you share the same core beliefs as this person? And I'm talking here not just Christianly speaking, but beliefs and attitudes about other things. Do her actions match what she says she believes? Are his morals, his personality, and his friends the type that you want? Do you have more in common than you have differences? Can you be yourselves around each other? Is this person close to your age? Is this person close to your experience level? Is she even prettier on the inside than she is on the outside? Do you like his attitudes? Do you like his values? Does this person have a good reputation, which is different than character? Character is what you are. Reputation is what people think you are. But to some extent, normally, reputation is a function of character. So do they have a good reputation? Do other people have positive things to say about this person that you're considering dating? Do adults like this person? That was a key question that we talked about for a little while. I suggested to them that it's good for them to get to know somebody at least to a certain extent before they actually go out with them on a date. And we talked about some myths that surround the whole area of dating that I think are harmful. One of the myths about dating that I think many young people believe is that dating brings instant happiness. If I could just get to that magic age that my parents have set where I could date, or if I could just get this person or that person to go out with me, that would bring a happiness that I don't have now. A lot of them seem to feel that if they can just find somebody special to latch onto, that all their problems are going to be solved and they'll live happily ever after. I suggested to them that only works for people who are happy already. I don't think you take one unhappy person and connect them with another unhappy person and come up with much of anything except an unhappy couple in most cases. Two unhappy people ordinarily don't make a happy couple. Usually an unhappy person is going to be blaming a lot of other people for their unhappiness. And when she doesn't have her mother around to blame anymore, she may look for somebody new to blame, and it may be you. So I suggested to them that this is not a cure-all for anything. We ought not to elevate the idea of dating above what it actually is. I think sometimes when they haven't dated but they see it in their future, it starts to mean more than it should. A second myth, the myth that it doesn't matter who you date as long as you eventually marry the right kind of person. I don't like that one either, because I believe very strongly that every relationship you choose takes you either closer to God or further away from being the person that God wants you to be. Everything affects you. Another myth, you'll never be whole until you're united with your other half. I suggested to them this morning that they can have a very fine life and be a very productive Christian person and never marry, and that may be best for some. It's not emphasized a lot in the church, it doesn't seem, but it ought to be emphasized. Jesus himself lives his entire life here single, and he's still single. Jesus is going to get married someday. We could say he's engaged, but he's not married. And it's been a long, long time. So, and Paul, of course, in 1 Corinthians 7 talks about how much more you can get done if you're not married, because you're not focusing on the things of your spouse. So we talked about that for a little while. Another myth. Religion is important, but it's a very personal matter, and it doesn't make much difference in dating and marriage. Now, I mention these myths to them, although they may seem obvious to you that these are myths. It's amazing some of the things that our young people wind up thinking. I don't know how they wind up thinking them.
Obviously, what we believe determines how we act and think and how we treat other people. Whether we're conscious of it or not at the time, our beliefs impact everything we do and say. That's not to say that everything we do is what we believe in doing, but our beliefs do impact everything we do and say. And then I told them that I've seen, and here I start talking from that lofty pinnacle of old age again, which I'm sure makes them want to gag. But I told them I've seen many such groups of young people as themselves, and I have. We have a new one about every 5 years or so. Mark and Ginger and I were talking just the other day about how they're now out of this group. They're in the next group. And I can remember what it was like to go to a two-week meeting when my age group wasn't there anymore. Lynn and I were amazed at the difference that that made along about 1971. So you get used to that eventually, but they're there as a group right now. And I told them that I've seen what happens. Dating non-Christians is one of the major reasons for losing interest in spiritual things among our young people. Once you're dating anybody, you're either going to keep dating them or you're going to break up with them. Now, if you make a commitment in your mind to the Lord to marry a Christian, if you marry at all, and then you're dating a non-Christian, breaking up is your only option. That's within your control. You can't control whether they become a Christian or not. So my question was, why start a relationship that's going to have to end anyway? If you want to have fun with that person, have it at the friendship level. But even then, even a friendship, a close friendship with a non-believer of the opposite gender can develop into a romantic relationship. So we've got to be aware of this. And remember what Jeremiah said, that the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Who can understand the human heart? There's nothing else so deceitful. And especially when we're young, not only then, but especially then, we tend, if we get involved romantically, to make decisions or be led by our heart rather than by our head. Our head, which is the Lord, that is. Christian young people who date non-Christians never start out by meaning to turn away from the Lord. Rather, they simply, gradually let somebody else become more important to them than God. Lovest thou me more than these? Do we or not? So it's definitely, the best thing we can say about marrying a non-believer is that it's not wise. And we talked yesterday a little bit about that concept. There's one other issue on that order, though, that was raised afterward. And that is the idea, if you're marrying in the Lord, just who is in the Lord? What does that mean? Would people from a denomination, for instance, qualify as being in the Lord so that you could marry them? It does seem to me, and I wanted to address this publicly. It was brought up privately. But I wanted to address it publicly because it seems to me, and I don't know what's causing this. I've got some ideas about what's causing it. It seems to me there is an increasing blurriness in the thinking of many people about who is a Christian and who is not that we didn't used to see. I attribute this in part to so-called Christian radio and TV, which many of our people spend a lot of time with, and they hear about Christian this and Christian that, and I'm not saying that that's all bad. I don't think it is all bad, but I think the thing you have to do when you listen or watch that, obviously, you have to have a good working knowledge of the Bible. If you don't, then you'd better not expose yourself to this other. And then if you do have a good working knowledge of the Bible, you've got to take what you hear on Christian radio and TV and strain all the Calvinism out of it because it's shot through. Virtually every breath those people take, they're spouting something Calvinistic. And we don't have time to go into what that is if we're not aware. But the point is, I think this is one thing that causes in the minds of some of us a blurring about the idea of who a Christian is. Now, the Bible says the same thing it's always said, obviously, that we know what I feel foolish talking to you about what the steps of salvation are. If a person has not been baptized for the remission of sins, how can they possibly be a child of God? And whether we like to believe it or not, that excludes almost everybody in the denominational world. So these people are not Christians. I'm not saying that there wouldn't be a single Christian in any denomination. That isn't my point. But it's far different to say that there may be somebody in one particular church or another who, on their study on their own, they came to the conclusion they need, on the basis of their faith and repentance, to be immersed in water for the remission of sins. Maybe they did that and they haven't studied their way out of that denominational thicket yet. That's one thing. But to give the impression or to believe yourself that these people are all Christians, or basically all Christians, or there is as great as proportion of Christians among them as there is among us. That's simply not true. It's not scriptural or biblical. So when I'm talking about only in the Lord, like we had in, brought up yesterday in 1 Corinthians 7:39, I'm talking about in the Lord by the biblical definition of that expression. If you don't marry in the Lord, then the best you can have is only two-thirds of a relationship, because you don't have that connectedness with God that you need together. Solomon married foreign women. We always point back to him as a man being turned away from God by them. I'll go a step further. I believe very strongly that it's best if our best friends are Christian friends. 1 Corinthians 15:33, and I had somebody in the class downstairs turn and read that. Evil communications corrupt good morals. Bad company turns us away. Statistically, they evangelize us into the world more than we evangelize them into the body of Christ when it's a dating relationship. Evangelistic dating just usually doesn't work very well. Not that being Christians is a guarantee of compatibility. That isn't what I'm saying. I think you should choose a Christian who matches you. As Richard pointed out in his class, only those who love God are willing to obey Him. And that's how we can show ourselves that we love God. Your non-Christian date has a better chance of evangelizing you into the world or into some denominational church than the other way around, statistically speaking. Of course, everybody tends to think they're going to be an exception to the rule. That's what keeps the gambling casinos going, and that's what keeps us doing some of the things we do, too. One of the dangers of dating a non-Christian, we talked about this some, is that they may, quote, become a Christian just to please you. I've seen this happen a number of times, and I think you have too. We can't read people's minds, but we can see what happens. There have been lots of young men baptized so that they could date one of the girls in the congregation. So we have to be aware of this. What you want is not just a churchgoer. You want somebody who puts Jesus first just as you do. When we take a look at the married people in the church, and I recommend it that they look upstairs at the married people in the church, see who it is that seems to live and enjoy their Christian faith the best. Who are the ones that have a commonality in their life all the way around? Is it the ones who married Christians or the ones who married non-Christians? And I think that question tends to answer itself. Another thing that I ask them, when you're dating someone, do your parents approve of this relationship? Proverbs 13:1, a wise son will accept his father's guidance, but a foolish son will reject it. And I pointed out the factor of experience. The parents have so much more experience, it's a shame to always be ignoring their words or to always be contradicting them. And I gave some personal examples from my young life about that I won't burden you with at this point. We did discuss, when do I cease being under the authority of my parents? We talked about that to some extent this morning. I told them that at least as long as you're living at home and you're financially dependent upon them, you're definitely under their authority at that point. But we did talk about that eventually and gradually. There is this turning of the key. And I gave an example from my grandfather that I've used before, but it just struck me so much when he said it. The difference between honor and obedience that comes at a given point. He was in the hospital at the age of almost 87, and he kept pulling the tubes out of his arms. And so he was kind of high-strung like I am, and he was thrashing around in this bed. So they tied him to the bed in the hospital. And I walked in one evening, and he was trying to get loose from these ropes, and he said 7 words to me that I've never forgotten. Cut me loose and take me home. And I contend that I honored him by disobeying him, because he would have died in the car on the way home if I had attempted to do what he said. Now, that wasn't a father, but it was a grandfather. He was a man that I had grown up believing that I should obey, and I'd grown up obeying him anytime he told me to do something. And it was an emotional change to see that I was now duty-bound to disobey him because of that particular situation. Eventually, I think that will come in most families. But that's not really the type of thing we're talking about when the children are the age of the ones downstairs. As I said a few minutes ago, when you're young, usually honor and obey are very close together.
The main point was that, in general, a dating relationship is either going to help you spiritually or hinder you spiritually. Very few of them are neutral. And my point about the parents was that your parents may see what's going on a little more clearly than you do at the time. And we had some specific questions about that, and I thought we had a good discussion about it. I don't think they all agreed with me, but I do think they considered what I was saying, and they were very nice to me. I love your kids. Anybody, let's see, we've got more time here. Anybody want to say anything up to this point? Okay. I was thinking for a moment that we stopped at 10 till, but we don't. Let's go on a little bit further. We haven't talked yet about this subject, and I want to run it by you and see what if you believe the same way I do about this. I think I'm a little... I don't know if it's old-fashioned or what about it, but the idea of asking people out. Traditionally, the boys ask the girls out. But now today, it seems like it often works the other way around. And I think maybe we need to sort out here between what's just traditional and customary and what is best, if there is a difference there. On this idea of girls asking boys out, some people say that it's okay for certain events. Other people say that it's never right. I know some of the boys like it when girls ask them out. I think others are put off by it. So there's a difference in people there. One of the problems that they face, I think, is that the girls, boys and girls of the same age, often the girl is more mature than the guy of the same age. And she often feels more confident about dating than he does. Personally, I believe that this makes it very possible for the girls to be too aggressive. And that's my chief concern here. If the girl, I believe, is telephoning the guy or asking a guy out more than he's asking her and so forth, I think she's pushing too hard. I believe he should be doing the leading. If he's not doing the leading in the initial stages, then how is that suddenly going to change if they do get married? How is he suddenly going to be the leader in the home then? I think he should be the leader from the very beginning. Not that it's wrong for her to call him ever. I don't mean that, especially if they have an established relationship. But I guess I don't personally believe that girls should ask guys out, unless it would be some rare occasion where maybe they have a special dinner where, when I was a kid, they called it WPA, Women Pay All. And if they were, I like those. If you're going to have one of those, then that would be a little bit of an unusual situation. But anyway, I thought I would pose the question to them about whether they think girls should ask guys out. And I don't really have any idea what kind of answer I'll get. We haven't talked about that yet. I also wanted to talk about this asking a girl out from another standpoint, too. I don't think girls often understand what a risk a young man is taking when he asks her out. I think even the most attractive and confident of the boys probably struggle, at least at times, with this. Because there is that tremendous fear of being rejected. And the male ego doesn't take that very well at all. If I ask her and she refuses, then that means she doesn't like me and I'm going to be humiliated. So if I don't ask her, at least I'm maintaining some hope. And I think this squelches a lot of interest on the part of the young men. A lot of times they'll use a circuitous approach then in trying to find out through the grapevine of their friends, will she go out with me if I ask her? This type of thing. And I think that's perfectly all right. I think there are advantages and disadvantages to that kind of a system. But it's understandable why they would do it, and I don't have any problem with that. I think it's important for him when he does ask her out to establish what they're going to be doing, what time she'll be home, and get this all lined out. I think not only are her parents more likely to let her go the more information they have, but in addition to that, she needs to know what they're going to be doing. If she doesn't have any idea what they're going to be doing, she doesn't know what to wear, she doesn't know when to be ready. So he needs to convey all this information during the conversation. I thought with them we might even do a little role-playing about that, depending on how our time goes. But I won't bore you with that part up here either. I just feel like that the young men have a special onus on them, and it's a difficult hurdle for them to get over, but I think it's part of growing up, and I don't like to see the girls be too aggressive and take over that role. We've got too many women in the church leading families anyway, often by default. We've got too many churches that are too much led by women, and men not taking the male role as they should. And I don't want to do anything that's going to foster more of that in the future. I wish we could get the men to take their role more seriously and take whatever flack comes with it. That's their job. I also am suggesting to them that when they talk about going out with a girl, that they avoid using the word date, because that sounds so formal and may make her uncomfortable. And that if you can't ask her out for something else that you really want to do, you might just volunteer to help her with her homework or some specific project or something. There are a lot of creative ways, in other words, to be with somebody that you'd like to get to know better in a non-date type of situation. And so we'll be discussing that, Lord willing, probably tomorrow. Now, when I say that I don't like the idea of girls asking guys out, at least not as a matter of habit, that doesn't mean that I don't think she can communicate to him. I have every confidence in our girls' ability to communicate to the boys when they have an interest. We were talking about eyes this morning. Girls with their eyes can communicate a great deal. If she just looks at him and tries to catch his glance once in a while, that's going to have some meaning to him. If she pays close attention to him when he speaks in their normal conversation, or she also may get a friend to pass on some information that didn't necessarily have to be told that it came from her, but this friend tell him that she's interested in him. A lot of that depends on the friend, how tactful this friend is. Sometimes that can backfire on them. But these kids know all that's going on in that area. They have almost a little underground community of their own. I sat in the back last night on purpose just to get a little different perspective. And it's amazing how different things look from the back rows than they do from up here. There's just a whole network of communication occurring among our young people. And that's not to say that they're not listening, because they're picking up an amazing amount of what's said in the class. You think they're not listening to these classes. You just listen to them overhear some of their conversations. They're quoting you the things that we say in the classes. So I don't mean that they're not listening, but they can listen and do some other things at the same time. We'll probably talk about double dating as opposed to single dating. We'll talk about conversation in dating. We'll talk about how to turn down dates, and I think Marvin was talking about that idea a little bit yesterday. This is a real difficult area, and I don't know much about it, but I think the idea here is to communicate in a loving and humble spirit, so that as much as possible the guy does not feel that you're rejecting him as a person, or doesn't think that that you don't think that you're better than he is. Now, some guys will turn this and use it against girls. You've all heard of these kind of situations where he'll say, I guess a pretty girl like you wouldn't want to ride in an old heap like my truck, you know. And then she almost feels obligated to get in his truck and ride with him to show that she doesn't think she's better than he is. So I don't like the manipulation on either side. I think the best thing is just to be honest. Assure him that you do appreciate his friendship, but you just don't want to get involved with him. I don't think you ought to put him off with excuses, because that doesn't solve the problem anyway, long term. As long as a guy thinks there's a chance, we're geared by nature to go for that chance. If there's one in a million, you go for that chance. And I don't think girls often understand this, the driving, somewhat competitive nature of a man, perhaps. But that, to some extent, is one of the differences between the genders. So I suggested to them this morning that they ought to maybe take some risks with people that are just average looking, or maybe even below average looking. She may not be beautiful on the outside, but if you get to know her, she may look more beautiful to you. It's in the eye of the beholder anyway. And we talked considerably about that point, that a girl might want to take a risk with a guy who doesn't on the surface seem to be the most desirable of dates. Maybe he's shy or quiet. But she may be God's instrument to help somebody blossom. And vice versa could be true. I haven't talked about talking with them yet, but I think one of the key issues on dates is what you say. I think personally that probably on their first dates they should have a list in their pockets of things to talk about that they can refer to so that when a dead air time comes up, they'll be able to remember something to talk about. Because this is one of the key issues. I don't know why it is, but I've often wondered if in some areas the teenage pregnancy rate was so high simply because young people were not very good at talking to each other. Those are really a couple of the main options we have, with talking or getting physical. The more options we have in talking, the more different ideas we can share back and forth, study the Bible together, etc., then the more our times and minds will be occupied, usually for good. If we can't do that, we don't know how to do that, then we tend to... it seems to me anyway, they tend to get more physical. Many times in rural areas where there aren't as many other possible activities perhaps. There's a higher percentage of teen pregnancy there than there is even in the cities sometimes. I've never quite understood that. This is the only explanation I've ever been able to think of. It may or may not be right. I've known of high school classes in rural areas where almost all the girls were pregnant before they graduated. It's just a very sad thing. So I think they need to have a little training from us, perhaps, about what to say on a date, and I intend to talk about how to talk and how to listen and how to be yourself and communicate who you are, what you are, what your interests are, communicate with each other, what your body language says on a date, because body language is very important. Body language is so important that when your words and your body don't agree, in other words, when they say different things, we almost invariably take what the body says rather than what the words say. If I come up here this afternoon and I say, "Boy, I feel great today," which do you take? You don't take my words seriously because my body language is obviously... You think I'm making a joke simply because of my body language. And the same is true on a date. If her body says yes, even when her mouth is saying no, he may try to take that yes for an answer. So we're going to need to talk about that. That's a little bit difficult to talk about with young people, I think. But I do think in this day when everything's so out in the open and brazen in the society around us, we're obligated to talk to our young people about some of these sexual issues, and I want to be just as plain with them as I need to be. I think... they deserve that from us, and probably we'll be doing that tomorrow or the next day. Also, we're going to be talking, Lord willing, about things to look for while you're relating to this person, while you're seeing them in lots of different kinds of situations. Oh, and we stop at two. Is that correct? Okay. While you're seeing them in lots of different kinds of situations, you need to look for different things in this person, and I'll try to remember to start tomorrow by giving you a list of the things to look for. I meant to leave a little time at the end, and I didn't. I'm sorry. Thank you for your fine attention and participation. You have 10 minutes.